Chevrolet GMC Studios. You're listening to Omaha Sports Insider, powered by AM 590 ESPN Omaha and KMTV. Now, more with Joe and Nick on OSI.
So much to get to in this hour, as per usual. Going to be talking fantasy football, and in most leagues, this would be the last week of the regular season before playoffs start. We'll be talking to Matt Letufsky at the bottom of the hour from the Sporting News to get your fantasy football advice and a chance to win a $20 gift card to the Ice House. And so much to talk to with our next guest, Brad Edwards, ESPN College Football Insider. Not just the college football playoff, but also a big-time coach stepping aside. And I want to start there, Brad, before we get into the college football playoff and the postseason, is just Urban Meyer, this announcement, it didn't seem to take many off guard too much, because this was sort of speculated throughout the season, whether it was going to be this year or next year, that maybe the end was near at Ohio State for Urban Meyer. So when you did get the announcement yesterday, were you overly shocked that this was happening?
No. In fact, last week, you remember, they kind of, I don't know if it's leaked is the right word, but remember that story started making the rounds that mm-hmm. there was a deal in place that Ryan Day was going to take over after the 2019 season.
Right.
And I'm not sure what the point of that was, but I remember being asked about it on Saturday. And I said, my question is, will he even make it to 2019 mm-hmm. in Urban? Because look, as much as that Michigan win might have energized him in the following days, I think it was really hard to ignore what we saw with our eyes, which was, you know, the toll that everything seemed to be taking on him physically. He just looked bad all year long, and you had to wonder whether he could even think about going through another year. And I think when he finally had time to kind of relax for a little bit and reflect on it, it was pretty obvious
yeah.
that he wasn't going to be able to do it for another year. And he made what I think is the smart decision for his health. Whatever you think of him personally, he did what he needed to do for his health. And so I'm glad for that reason that he made what I think is the right choice.
Yeah, and kind of along those lines, Brad, do you fall into the camp that you think this is truly it for Urban Meyer as a college football head coach, or do you think that there's pretty strong chance that, you know, after a couple of years of hopefully getting his health worked out, we see him back on the sidelines again in the right situation?
Yeah, I think it really depends on what the nature of this health situation is. Now, obviously, whatever it was at Florida that, you know, that required him to leave there for health reasons was something that after a few months, I think he felt like he had it back under control and could manage it, whatever. And that's why he got back into coaching a year later at Ohio State. And of course, you know, he's had another great run. Now, if this is something that they figure that they can kind of take care of medically and that it shouldn't resurface, then I would certainly expect that he'd be back on the sideline. But if this is something that's always going to linger and is going to be aggravated by stress, I don't see how he could get back into coaching at the level that he wants to coach at. Look, I mean, maybe you could take a job at a lower division and coach without all the same stress, but that doesn't seem like Urban Meyer to me. He's a guy who's, you know, motivated by winning at the highest level, and I don't know that he'd get the same enjoyment out of that. So I think it really depends on, you know, how serious and how long-term of a health issue it is.
In 5 years, Brad, what are we saying about Urban Meyer and his place as one of the greatest college football coaches? Do we, at that point, in your opinion, do we forget maybe a little bit more about how this season started off and some of the things that he's been linked to even at Florida? I mean, is that something that kind of goes away with time and that we just kind of look at the performance and that just ridiculous success rate on the field?
I don't think so. I think that stuff will linger. Certainly you'll always be able to look at the record books and see his amazing winning percentage. He's one of not too many people in the history of the game that has at least three national titles. Obviously, he's one of an even in smaller club that's won national titles at more than one school. But, you know, I think about Joe Paterno, and, you know, I realize that in a lot of ways, you know, what happened there with Jerry Sandusky is looked at as a much worse thing than what was going on at Ohio State. But that's something that I think is forever tied to Paterno. I mean, I can't hear Joe Paterno's name today and not think about Jerry Sandusky.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, no one's really putting Zach Smith in that category. But I think when you combine, you know, what happened there at Ohio State with all the issues that players at Florida had, and I mean, look, Aaron Hernandez was one of those guys, and so, you know, there are plenty of reasons to question some of the decisions that he made with players at Florida, you know, with at least one of his coaches at Ohio State, and I think that for as long as there are people, you know, still out there who covered Urban as a head coach, there will be people who just can't forget that part of it, in addition to just how outstanding he was as a football coach.
Talking to Brad Edwards, ESPN College Football Insider. Well, Brad, we had the selection show this past Sunday. Do you feel like the committee got the four correct teams in the correct order into the college football playoff?
Correct is an interesting term. I kind of like the term correct better than best. Look, I think that one of the biggest problems the committee created for itself is using that word best, because I think most of us kind of define best or better as, you know, who would win the majority of the time if two teams played each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I have absolutely no reservation in, you know, believing that Georgia is one of the four best teams this year. I think they would, to me, would beat whether it's Oklahoma or Ohio State or even Notre Dame, who's all the way up at number three and undefeated, that Georgia would beat all three of those teams the majority of the time they played them. Certainly not every time, but the majority of the time. And so by that definition of better or best, I think they're one of the four best. Do they deserve to be in? I think you could certainly look at the LSU game and say, look, you got two losses, but one of them was bad. There's no excuse for Georgia losing by 20 at LSU, you know, losing by one score, maybe, but not by 20. And then even with that, to have had the opportunity in the SEC championship game up 14 in the second half. And I realize there are a whole lot of teams out there. In fact, maybe all of them, but Clemson, that might not be able to hold off Alabama, even if you gave them a 14-point lead in the second half. But still, they had their chance. They didn't seal the deal. And I'm fine with someone else getting a chance. I still believe, though, if you're truly saying you're getting the four best teams, then you failed. That's not what you got. But I don't think that's what people want. I don't think that's what the committee was set up to do. So they just need to get rid of that word best, find something else to call it. And I think they got the teams that most people wanted them to get.
Deserving? That really, is that the right way, deserving?
Yeah, that maybe, mm-hmm. yeah, deserving, or, you know, just the ones that earned it with what they did on the field. And, you know, so I'm perfectly fine with the four that are in there.
Brad Edwards joining us, ESPN College Football Insider. Brad, I know another thing that, depending on how you look at it, and I'm really curious on your thoughts, Washington State, their AD, he said that he felt that the reason that Washington State will not be in a New Year's Six game is because there was a Pac-12 bias. Do you buy into that? Do you think what you saw from Washington State, that they legitimately have a gripe there?
Yeah, I don't know that there's a bias. I think the conference isn't very good.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. You know, that, I mean, so here's the way I look at it. Like, everyone wants to focus on non-conference schedules whenever they kind of dissect teams, you know, within this playoff era. And I don't think that the non-conference necessarily needs to be separated from the conference. I think it's the entire body of work. Just what's your overall schedule look like? And if your conference happens to have a down year, then that's a bad time to play a weak non-conference schedule. And I don't think anybody could argue that the Pac-12 wasn't really down this year. And they were down last year. Washington State picked a bad year to play nobody out of conference. And because of that, they have one win over a team that was ranked by the committee at the end of the season, and that was Utah. And look, I mean, you can say that they should get benefit of doubt over a team like Florida with three losses. But Florida, even though they do have three losses, they you know, beat a couple of teams that were ranked higher than Utah by the committee, or actually, you know, Mississippi State, I think, was ranked one spot behind. But, you know, but Florida has some wins that are better than what Washington State has. And look, I would be perfectly fine with Washington State getting in. I certainly don't think Florida did anything special to deserve to get benefit of doubt. And you could say that maybe that's an SEC bias, but I don't think anyone is shortchanging the Pac-12 and not giving due credit to teams that were really good. I don't think that the teams in the Pac-12 are any better than where the committee ranked them.
Well, and Brad, you know, you put the Pac-12 into this conversation. You can probably throw the Big Ten actually into this conversation as well. The leagues that play nine conference games, they just seem to have a harder time getting into the college football playoff. Now, I know the Big 12 is the exception again this year, but, you know, is it? Do you feel like it's worth re-examining the way that they go about these things? I mean, you know, I know even today Jim Delaney was talking about maybe kind of doing away with divisions and having just the two best teams in this league play for a conference championship. I mean, you feel like we're getting to the point where leagues do need to examine what needs to be done?
Well, I'll tell you what, it worked for the Big 12 this year.
Yep.
You know, having Oklahoma, Texas, because I think if Oklahoma had a little bit weaker opponent, like Ohio State had a little bit weaker opponent in the conference championship game than if they played the second best team, that probably made the difference. And so, yeah, I think there's something to it. Now, of course, if you look at it from the other perspective, which is the SEC, ACC, having only eight conference games and the fact that those two conferences have been in this thing every year. I can't attribute that to the eight conference games just because it's been Alabama and Clemson. It's been Alabama every year in the SEC. Well, Georgia got in last year with Alabama, but then it's been Clemson every year except the first one in the ACC. And I think if you're looking at Alabama and Clemson, I think it's kind of silly to make the argument that if they had had to play one more game against the middle of the pack team in their conference that they wouldn't have gotten there. I think those two teams in this particular span of years, I don't think it would have mattered whether you gave them a ninth or a tenth conference game. They were still going to get there. But I, if you look at it from the Big Ten angle, you look at Ohio State, you know, 2 years in a row barely missed out on the playoff. And in both of those years, they had a crucial loss, a crucial lopsided loss on the road to a team from the Big Ten West. Now, I can't tell you that that's the team they would have missed if there had only been eight conference games instead of nine. But we know that the ninth conference game, it's one more game against the other division. And whether that was Purdue this year or Iowa last year, that's the type of game. It's the, you know, it's that one extra game against what, you know, on average is going to be a middle of the pack team in the conference. And every other year, it's going to be a game on the road. And that's what's done in Ohio State 2 years in a row. And so I think it's probably fair to say that at least one of those 2 years, they might have made the playoff if they didn't have that ninth conference game. And that same thing applies to the Big 12. It applies to the, well, maybe not the Big 12 because there aren't divisions, but the Pac-12. And so, yeah, I think it's a legitimate conversation to have if you're the Big 10 as to whether you should try it a different way, maybe not going to eight, but certainly just trying to ensure that you have as strong of an opponent as you possibly can for the conference championship.
Well, Brad, as you look at the two college football semifinals, probably safe to say that Clemson-Notre Dame gives us the better shot at being a competitive game than Oklahoma or Alabama. Do you think the Sooners can, you know, keep it sporty against the Crimson Tide?
Yeah, I think it is Clemson-Notre Dame, and I guess a lot of people would lean that direction because Notre Dame's undefeated. I still think that on the Clemson side, you have a true freshman quarterback, and while he's obviously very talented, you know, they have not played. Clemson has not played against good defenses this year, and I would be interested to see what kind of problems Trevor Lawrence might have if his running game is shut down by a good defensive team. How much of that load is he going to be able to carry by himself? And so that's kind of what I'm not sure about. Like, is Notre Dame good enough defensively to be able to kind of take away that Clemson running game that's been so dominant this year? He obviously is capable of making a lot of big throws, but can he do it consistently enough, especially on that stage? It's not something you would ever assume that a true freshman can do. no matter how talented. So, yeah, that's the one I look to. I mean, look, with the Alabama-Oklahoma game, there are two injuries right now that could be very, very key to this game, one on each side. The first one is Hollywood Brown for Oklahoma, their most dangerous receiver. We still haven't heard official word as to whether he's going to be able to go. He was injured in the Big 12 championship game, didn't come back. Their offense will not be as good if he can't play, and that's going to make the game feel even more of a long shot for Oklahoma. But if he can go, but Tua is not 100% for Alabama, yeah, that's an equalizer.
Mm-hmm.
Because look, I know that Alabama's offense at full strength, you know, clicking on all cylinders, I've seen what's happened this year when they have played against defenses the caliber of Oklahoma. And what's happened is that they've scored about 60 points in three quarters, and then they sat out their starters in the fourth quarter. So I don't have any doubt in my mind Alabama could score 70 on Oklahoma if the first team offense is out there the whole time and Tua is healthy. So I think that's the big question. What everyone wants to see is how much can Oklahoma's offense do against Alabama's defense, but it really won't matter if Tua is healthy. So I think really that's the biggest story in this game, is that high ankle sprain that he has, and when will he be able to come back, and, you know, is he playing like he did for most of the season?
Brad Edwards, ESPN College Football Insider, also on Twitter at JBradEdwards. Appreciate it, Brad. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
You too, sir. All right, up next, we're going to stick with the college football theme here. Earlier in the week, we told you that Turner Gill, of course, former Husker and now former head coach at Liberty, had resigned his coaching post and announced his retirement so that he could be with his ailing wife. Today, he had a press conference where he talked a little bit about that decision, and it was very, very emotional stuff from Turner Gill. We'll play a clip of that for you next on AM 590.
Yes, beautiful.
This is Omaha Sports Insider, online and on air. On air. OSI, your sports source, powered by KMTV and AM 590 ESPN Omaha.
Kind of some emotional audio coming your way here. Nick heard this earlier today. So Turner Gill, of course, former Husker, former coach at Liberty, former coach at Kansas, announced his retirement from coaching football. He is going to be with his wife, who is currently ill, and wants to be able to spend more time with her. I think people around here probably understand what kind of a man Turner Gill is and the things that he stands for. But in case you need any further validation of that, this is Turner Gill talking about the conversation that he had with his staff and with his players in regards to his retirement.
The summer of 2016, we learned that my wife, Gail, has an electrical problem with her heart. After visiting about it, Gail and I both wanted us to be able to get Liberty through the transition and through the last 3 years of my contract. Due to several factors over the last few months, I have decided that I need to retire from coaching this year. President Falwell, Ian McCall have been very supportive of my decision. They had offered me a new multi-year contract, and they have been very good to my family and me over the years. I will miss my staff and the players immensely. I'm extremely sad to leave them. However, I cannot work over 90 hours a week and be there for my wife at the same time. I know that my staff understands that, and I hope that my players receive that information as another lesson in being a man and taking care of his family. Talked to the staff yesterday, I guess it was right about 3 o'clock, is when they formally got information that I was retiring and let them know. Obviously, probably one of the toughest things that I've ever had to do. Those are the guys who have done all the work. Those are the guys who deserve all the attention. Those are the people who, again, 90, 95 hours, whatever, a week, to getting our football team ready to play their best football game they can play every week. Just was a tough thing for me to say, to state to them that I was retiring. Because it affects many people's lives, their jobs, their families. I know they understand the reason, but it's still hard. So that's kind of how it all took place. I didn't talk to the players shortly after that at 3:15 or so, 3:20, and let them know. Obviously another emotional situation there, all my sons, you know, they come here again, 18 to 22 year old young men are controlling my livelihood, controlling all of our coaches' livelihoods. They trusted in me, trusted in our coaches, and now to have that, I don't know if you want to say disrupted, because I know that sometimes players have been let down by their fathers. So
So me as a coach to say I'm retiring, I didn't want them to take it, then I've let them down too.
You know, it's something that you're right, the consistency of the man that Turner Gill was when he was at Nebraska as a quarterback, as a longtime assistant for Tom Osborne, and then when he started taking over programs, there were so many things that you could tell Turner Gill, and he'll tell you to this very day, that he took from Tom Osborne. And we always, and it's funny, we were talking about the real big retirement, and nothing against Turner Gill, but the big news yesterday in Urban Meyer. And, you know, guys sometimes are perceived a lot differently as coaches, as leaders of football programs. And, you know, when Urban Meyer, when his livelihood was being challenged because of the domestic violence incident involving one of his assistant coaches, I mean, it just seemed like this was a guy that maybe was blind to the bigger picture, you know, outside of football, and what really should, not what maybe really mattered to him, but what really should matter. And then you hear a guy like Turner Gill, who is hoping that his players don't feel abandoned by him, that his players understand exactly why he is stepping away, and that guilt that and that sadness that he could obviously tell he was overcome with. I mean, right there, and not because he's, you know, somebody that we all know here in this state, but right there is that perfect example of the coaches that we should spend more time praising, and coaches that we should spend more time talking about their legacy. And this is nothing against, you know, the Urban Meyers of the world, but you hear that a head coach at Liberty that is leaving for absolutely the right reasons, you know, is going to be there for his wife and going to send the message to his student athletes, a guy that's truly trying to teach them, you know, what is the right things to do, is trying to teach them that, hey, you have to take care of your family. And he was in a position that with his current job, he was not in a position to fully take care of his wife. And he's hoping that will go over well with his players. But then to mention, you know, how a lot of these guys have come from broken homes and didn't have a father figure, or had a father that let them down, that he didn't want them to think that of him, because as he said, that those are his sons. Like that right there, when you think of the people that you want to send your son or daughter to school and play collegiate athletics for, it's men like that. It's men that get it. It's men that, yeah, you know what, they want to win every game, they want to be successful, but when every competition, when every game is over with, they want to make sure that they are making that person better. And, I mean, that was 2 minutes right there of Turner Gill. If you hadn't heard it before, if you didn't know the man he was right there, or the reason why people really did want to send their sons to be under his leadership, there you go. That's a perfect example of
and
it.
And it's safe to say that college football could probably use more dudes like
Absolutely.
Turner Gill, no doubt about it. All right, up next, fantasy football time. Matt Litovsky of the Sporting News along to answer your questions. A $20 gift card to the Ice House is up for grabs just for calling and asking a question of Matt. 402-573-0590 is the number to call. We'll get your fantasy team straightened out for you next on AM 590.
Yes, beat them all.
It's the Omaha Sports Insider's Fantasy Football Update. Call 402-573-0590 right now. With your fantasy football questions, it's your weekly chance to get your team right. Brought to you by the Ice House Sports Bar, your place to follow your fantasy football team with free Wi-Fi and great specials. The Ice House Sports Bar, 108th and Maple, Omaha's best sports bar, period.
Okay, jump on those lines now, 402-573-0590. Your chance to win a $20 gift card to the Ice House for our fantasy football segment. Got a couple lines open, 402-573-0590. Ask a question and have a chance to win a $20 gift card to the Ice House. We welcome in Matt Litovsky of the Sporting News. Matt, we've got James Conner out this week. We just found out Emmanuel Sanders probably
cooked.
Has
He's
a
done.
Torn
he
Achilles.
Does. It's official.
Mitch Trubisky sounds like is a full go on Sunday night. Lots to discuss. Lots happening here in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, it's what happens every year. In the you know, you do all this prep in August, and you have your draft, and you do all this. And then the fantasy playoffs come around, and you're starting a guy named Jeff Wilson Jr. who you didn't know existed
right.
2 weeks ago, and he's somehow leading teams to fantasy titles, which, you know, really exposes how useless my job is as someone who writes about this for a living. But nonetheless, I'm going to pretend I know what's going to happen and power through.
Well, I want to put this one to bed then. Just on what you brought up, this was maybe the best tweet I've gotten. And we do have one more line open, 402-573-0590. So jump on that now. This came from Mitchell. And I detect some sarcasm here, but says, should I drop Aaron Rodgers for Mark Sanchez?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine that's not real. Now, if you want to know, should you bench Aaron Rodgers? Possibly. If you want to know, should you pick up the Giants defense or whatever defense is facing Mark Sanchez, I would say yeah. Definitely. But, it's anytime Mark Sanchez is involved, you know something weird's going to happen.
Yep. No doubt. Let's get Ryan in Omaha in here, get the calls fired up. Hello, Ryan.
How's it going?
Excellent.
Good. Question for Matt here. So, first round of the playoffs in a PPR league, and I got a dilemma. Now with Emmanuel Sanders being out, I have to decide between starting Tyler Boyd with a Jeff Driskel thrown to him or a Case Keenum throwing to Cortland Sutton.
Yeah, it is a tough one because they both, you know, Sutton has the much better matchup on paper, but Boyd has just been way more consistent and just a better player. And he, you know, look, last week he had Driskel thrown to him in a tougher matchup and had a pretty good game. There's garbage time potential in that game. I do like them both, but if I got to pick one of them, I'm going to take Boyd just because he's more proven. And, I mean, you're right. I don't think the quarterback is that big of a difference, honestly. Keenum's probably better, but I don't know if he's a ton better.
Leaves line open, 402-573-0590. Let's go to Ernie in Omaha next. What's up, Ernie?
Hey, guys. All right, two questions. I need a tight end between Vance McDonald and Njoku for Cleveland. And then I need a defense out of Tennessee and the Rams. Thanks, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's Tennessee. I mean, obviously the Rams have been very good this year, but, you know, the Bears offense, they get Trubisky back. That sort of makes it a bit different. Being on the road for the Rams, I think, makes it tough. But Tennessee, look, we talked about bad quarterbacks. Cody Kessler, not impressive last week at all. Hasn't been impressive in the past. He doesn't turn it over a ton, but he takes enough sacks and doesn't help the team move the ball that I think you got to like Tennessee in a home Thursday game. The tight ends are real tough. Those are two of the few good ones this week. I think we have a rank back-to-back. I've Njoku a little bit higher. I think he's been a little bit of a disappointment this year. Panthers, though, they've been number one in fantasy points allowed to tight end all season. They've been better the past three games, but I think a lot of that is because of matchups, and also Cameron Brate dropped a sure touchdown last week. So I still think Njoku has a better matchup there.
This is Justin and Papillion. Fire away, sir.
All right, two questions for you. First one, since obviously I can't play Kareem Hunt, at least it wouldn't be very smart. Either need Sony Michelle or Chris Carson. And then should I either start Jimmy Graham or Jordan Reed at tight end?
Yeah, so there we get back to the Sanchez factor, and I think you got to go Graham. I mean, I'm not super high on him with the thumb, but he hauled in a bunch. He had 11 targets last week, hauled in a bunch, so I still think he's a better play. And the running backs, Carson, he's got a finger injury. Who knows if he's going to play? That's a Monday night game. They're facing a real tough Vikings defense. So I think Michelle will be fine. It is a little worrisome to see Rex Burkhead back and get carries. But Michelle was still the workhorse last week, and I like the matchup a lot this week down in Miami.
All right, line's open, 402-573-0590. Go to Larry in Omaha next. What's up, Larry?
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Awesome. Hey, I love your show, first off.
Thank you.
And my question is, Aaron Rodgers or Matt Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one, obviously, but playing each other head-to-head. I think it's got to be Rodgers, though. He's at home. And, you know, the Falcons' defense has been really bad against quarterbacks. It has. And, yeah, they show up when they're facing guys who can't throw, like Lamar Jackson. But other than that, they give up a lot of touchdowns. And I think that Aaron Rodgers will take advantage. You know, I think he'll have a little jolt from the new coach. He's looking to go out there and have a good game for that reason. And just Matt Ryan on the road in December in Green Bay, I don't know if you can really trust him.
It's Chris in Omaha next with us. Fire away, sir.
Yeah, two questions. Quarterback in half-point PPR, it's either Drew Brees or Jared Goff. And then for a flex position, same league, half-point PPR, Julian Edelman, Mark Ingram, or Austin Eckler? Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Eckler's got a great matchup, but I do worry this week about Justin Jackson getting more touches. I mean, Eckler can still produce, but if I'm looking at the guys you mentioned, I would go Ingram. Obviously, he's been a little rough two games in a row, but this matchup's fantastic. We know he can produce against anyone, and when he goes off, he can go off big. For quarterbacks, I think you got to go back to Breeze again. It's all about the matchup. He disappointed last week, but Goff on the road in Chicago, don't really like that matchup at all. I think the Saints just go off huge this week. They owe the Bucs one after what happened in week one, too.
Still got some time to get a call or two in if you want, 402-573-0590. Todd on Twitter says he's got a PPR. He needs to know between Josh Gordon or Jeff Wilson Jr. in a flex. He lost Connor and Sanders to injury.
Yeah, so I'm not quite as high on Wilson Jr. just because I think the Broncos' run defense has been a lot better lately. And, you know, his numbers were a little inflated last week because they had no other active running backs really after Breida got hurt. That said, I still think he's a better play there. I do think he'll get some receptions. That'll help with PPR. And Gordon is he's solid, but he might be a little bit touchdown or bust at this point, big player bust. And, in that match, they're just not throwing as much. I like him. He's still pretty good. But I'll take the guaranteed touches with the running back.
Aaron in Omaha joins us here on the show. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, I got Tom Brady or Jared Goff.
Yeah, real tough one with Brady, not really doing much lately. Goff a little, higher floor, I think, maybe matchup proof. But, again, I'm just going to default to the matchup. The Dolphins aren't terrible against quarterbacks, but I still think it's a more favorable matchup. I think the weather will be more favorable, and I do like Brady there. I mean, you might just be looking at hoping to get 250 yards and two touchdowns, but I think Brady can do that, or at least maybe has a little better chance to do that than Goff.
All right, TJ next door to us has a question. What's up, TJ?
That's right. So, Matt, all my injuries have finally caught up to me. I've lost four in a row, but I'm hanging on to that final playoff spot here. I need to win this Sunday.
Now, hold on. So that means that we want the good advice this time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Just only
the
best.
This is the time for the good advice. Yeah.
Okay, the real advice. Thank you.
What do I do with my flex here? Do I go with Isaiah Crowell, Kyle Rudolph, Derrick Henry, or Sterling Shepard?
Well, I think it's Crowell. I know he's got a little bit of an injury, but you look at what happened last week. I was encouraged that he had 21 carries and 5 targets against a tough run defense and did pretty well with it. So this week, much more favorable matchup. He's been one of these guys you can't guess right on all year. But I just like the trend that I saw last week, Elijah McGuire taking a step back, Crowell taking a step forward. So as long as he's active and healthy, I think he's definitely the guy.
Twitter question here from Greg and wants to know, half-point PPR, needs help with the flex, DJ Moore or Adam Humphries? Also wants to know, can you trust Mark Ingram as an RB2 this week?
Yeah, I think so. Like I said, I just think, that's a prime bounce-back spot for that whole team, and he's a guy who, last week's game was really weird, obviously, for that whole team. They didn't have the ball control they normally have, and thus he couldn't get in the flow and get touches. So I think big bounce back this week. The wide receivers is tough, pretty similar. I do like Moore, though, a little bit more than Humphries, just because even though the matchup's really good for Humphries, I don't know. I don't trust a guy like Adam Humphries to score 4 times in a row. I wish I had better analysis to that. But that's what I got for you. And I do think DJ Moore has really stepped up, even though he was a little bit of a disappointment last week. I kind of like him this week. Another good matchup against the Browns, so I think he can come through.
All right, your final call of the day. Matt, say hi to Matt. What's up?
Hey, how's it going? Half-point PPR, flex position. Do I go Mike Thomas, Galladay from the Lions, or Tevin Coleman with the Falcons? Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's got to be Thomas again. He's great, and the Saints, fantastic matchup. He's due to have a big bounce back. Galladay would be my number two there. Even though it's a tough matchup on paper, he's going to get enough targets. But, Thomas is the guy you really can't sit at this point.
All right, and my final question for you, Matt Litovsky, is, and this is college football related, you are a Mizzou guy. How excited were you for the news of Kelly Bryant?
I mean, it's between the Chase Daniel starting and Kelly Bryant now.
It's been a big week Mizzou, for Mizzou quarterbacks.
Mizzou quarterback bonanza. But, no, it's good. I mean, why not? I don't like the fact that it probably helps Barry Odom get an extension, but nonetheless, we'll take it. We're better off for next year than I thought we were going to be. So, half the battle.
There you go. Matt Litovsky with the Sporting News. He joins us every Wednesday at this time with our fantasy football fantasy football advice segment with our sponsor, I should say, by the Ice House Sports Bar. Your chance to get a $20 gift card to the Ice House Sports Bar for calling in and asking a question to Matt. Of course, you can follow him on Twitter at MLatufsky with any and all of the fantasy football updates. Matt, appreciate it. Have a great week.
All right. Thanks, guys.
You bet, man. All right. So to cap off the 4 o'clock hour here, what do you say we roll up our sleeves real quick, Nick, and have a good old-fashioned baseball discussion? Something interesting reported earlier today by Jason Stark of The Athletic that I'm sure will stoke your emotions, my emotions, any baseball fan's emotions just a bit.
Are the Indians trade somebody else?
Nope. It has nothing to do with your Indians or my Braves. We'll leave it at that. AM 590.
ESPN tomorrow.
This is Omaha Sports Insider, online and on air. On air. OSI, your sports source, powered by KMTV and AM 590 ESPN Omaha.
Report today, Nick, by Jason Stark of The Athletic. No, it has nothing to do with St. Louis trading for Paul Goldschmidt, which you're a Cardinals fan.
Which is a big get if you're a Cardinals fan, even if it is just for a year.
It really is. Well, here's the rub. So, Jason Stark today with a story out. Apparently, last month at the owners' meetings, baseball's competition committee gave the commissioner, quote, strong backing to try to put something in place to limit shifts in Major League Baseball. Stark does a really good job here, Nick. He uses the advanced stats folks at Sports Info Solutions. They looked at all of the shifts this last year and tried to determine how many more hits there would have been this last season, what guys' batting averages would have been, you know, some of the real, like, kind of those things you sit there and like, oh my God, somebody sat and watched every inning of every Major League Baseball game and picked this kind of stuff up. But there are operations that do just exactly that. They estimate there would have been, in 2018 alone, there would have been 500 additional hits spread out across the year. From 2016 to 2018 would have been about an additional 1,200 hits over a three-year span. This year, a one-year increase, there were 8,000 additional shifts in Major League Baseball. Do you like it or do you not like it?
This is one that I've kind of been on the fence about, because my initial reaction to anybody complaining about shifts is what I've always valued in hitters, and maybe this is just not the reality when it comes to Major League Baseball, which is kind of weird because, you know, the game of baseball, when you're trying to develop young people at the high school level and the collegiate level, is you value guys that can hit tall fields. You value guys that have the ability that if they are shifting because of your tendency to pull the baseball, that you are able to let a pitch travel deep in the zone and be able to go the other way with it. You know, like I think that shows the type of hitter that you would want to be, because at some point that is going to be extremely valuable and you're going to be able to go on to the collegiate level and do good things. You're going to go on to have the opportunity to be a Major League Baseball contributor because you have the ability to hit to all fields. Now, obviously, you got to be a talented hitter to do so. And I think eliminating shifts basically doesn't put a heavy emphasis on that. You know, when there's a gaping hole, you know, down the third baseline, and guys are still unable to be able to let the ball travel and hit it through that hole and that shift, it's kind of frustrating, because, and I'm sure for a lot of college coaches, and I'm sure for a lot of high school coaches, in the developmental stages, that is what they're really trying to emphasize, and that comes up in very big moments. Now, I understand, though, in the Major League Baseball game, you don't have the running game on the base path as much as you do in college baseball, as much as you do in high school baseball. So maybe that element is a little bit undervalued. But watching how long some of these games would take, and especially in the postseason, with certain counts dictating a shift, it's like, oh, well, it's 2-0 now, and now we have to shift. Because the scout report says with a 2-0 or a 3-1 or a power count that this guy is going to pull the baseball. So we need to shift in between pitches. Like, to me, that does start to get a little frustrating to watch. And so there is that part where I think it has gotten to the point, it's gotten so excessive to the point that I'm not a huge fan of it, but I still feel there needs to be some kind of emphasis when it comes to being able to hit the other way and hit away from these shifts.
I don't know exactly what the rule would look like, Nick. I don't know. I would assume that it could be something as simple as you have to, when the pitch is delivered, have two guys on one side of second base.
Yeah,
and then you get into the question of, you know, what technically defines an infielder. Are you going to have some instances where you bring one of your outfielders in to stand on the edge of the grass? I don't know. I mean, it's – look – I'm kind of with you. I feel like we've become so obsessed with the emphasis for this is we want to add more action to the game. We want to add more excitement. We want to have more hits in the game. I question, you know, you're talking about adding more excitement, you know, increasing the pace of play and stuff like that. To me, baseball doesn't feel broken. I think baseball could do a better job of marketing itself. I think they could do a better job of trying to, you know, reach young audiences. But I'm not necessarily sure that monkeying around with some of the rules of the game is the best way to reach that audience. I mean, ask yourself this. If you're Major League Baseball looking to make your game more exciting, you're talking about, I think it equates out to three extra hits per night across all of baseball.
Yeah.
All of baseball, three extra hits per day. Are those three extra hits, which are in all likelihood going to be singles, is it going to make that big of an impact to somebody who doesn't like baseball anyway? Are they all of a sudden going to be like, oh, well, defensive shift? Or is it better to say, maybe we should, you know, put a re-emphasis on, for our hitters, learning how to hit oppo as opposed to trying to hit a home run or strike out every single time they're at the plate?
Yeah, and I find it hard to believe that these guys would have to learn that. I feel like they should already know that, and it just hasn't been something that they've really had to use or utilize all that much. But, you know, this is kind of the thing that I've not been a fan of with Rob Manfred. I feel like there is a lot of attention being paid to sort of that fan, that casual fan that really is never going to like baseball, but this is the things that really chops them. And so this is the things that need to change, and I'm just I don't like that.
Big time flip for Nebraska football recruiting today. That's next on AM 590.
ESPN tomorrow.